Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this podcast we'll be looking at news up to the 23rd of September. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello Kate.
Hello Rod.
Our first story, Kate, asks how to make your coaching contagious. This is the story that two of Europe's biggest football clubs have harnessed key business partnerships to export their coaching methods to developing nations. On the 19th of September, it emerged that Borussia Dortmund had tied it with marketing firm World One Sports in a two-year initiative to send coaches to schools in India, and Tottenham Hotspur announced via their official website that the club has held five football clinics for more than 240 children in Myanmar. Both teams are hoping that their specific approaches to coaching will take root among their respective trainees, an objective that highlights the contagious nature of coaching. In a recent Retail Touchpoints interview, Jim Harter, Gallup Chief Scientist, Workplace, argues that the modern workforce needs coaches rather than bosses, and says that there's a cascade effect that starts with leadership, which has to set a clear purpose that says, here's what our organisation is about in a succinct way that everyone can relate back to their jobs. Kate, in what other ways can leaders achieve a contagious or cascade effect with the coaching they provide?
Well, as our recently published research report, Don't Tell Coach, emphasises that a coaching approach to managing your staff is much more suitable not only for today's young generation who are demanding more from their managers, but as a way of dealing with the unexpected. But I think what's interesting is how often coaching is used to describe so many interventions. And of course, the whole field of coaching's developed from sports coaching. But rather than focusing on the technical skills of football, I think what is being argued here, it's more an approach. It will be about sportsmanship. It will be about transparency. It will be about fairness. It will be about how you treat your young players. I think those of us who follow rugby union, if ever you hear Owen Farrell, for example, from Saracens, talking about their success, he always says we, and he always gives credit to his fellow team members, and that's known as the Saracens way. And I think this is what really is being emphasized here. And the important point that's picked up by Jim Harter is the role of any manager, any coach, as a role model. And if you adopt great and fair coaching approaches, that the generations that initially look up to you and then take over from you will imitate those behaviours. So that's how you do it. You do it by doing it really well without exception.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our second story looks at Radio 5 Live's Wake Up to Money, which suggests that it's highly likely that self-set salaries be the future of wages. The report interviewed 25-year-old Cecilia Manduka, who works for Grantree, a firm that helps companies secure government funding and allows all 45 of its employees to choose their own salaries. Following a shift in her responsibilities, Manduka gave herself an additional £7,000 per annum, boosting her pay to £37,000. I felt a lot of doubts asking for that raise, she said. It took a lot of talks with other people. When I spoke with my colleagues internally and asked for advice, the advice they gave me was that, yes, I did deserve it and I was worth it. Addressing the BBC report in his regular column at Real Business, Pimlico Plumbers boss Charlie Mullins explains that a recent salary transparency experiment at his firm made a real difference, and praises the tech sector for sparking an innovative trend. Kate, are self-set salaries a refreshing solution to an old problem or a potential administrative nightmare?
If we go back to the example here from Cecilia, she's asked her colleagues whether she's worth a £7,000 pay rise. And when it's their turn to ask her whether they are worth similar sort of pay rises, is she going to be able to say no? I think you're setting up a sort of situation where people are rewarding each other because they've been rewarded previously. Absolutely an advocate for transparency, but I think one would have to be extremely cautious if going to let people set their own salaries, because we see so frequently a sort of groupthink can set in and they all start believing that they're worth it. And then we've got a different set of problems. So transparency and clear criteria for why people receive the salaries that they do, I think is probably more helpful than a lot of people going around lobbying for pay rises.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story goes to look at ways to promote women in business and give them the recognition they deserve. Reviewing this month's Forbes list of most innovative leaders, Katie Burke, Chief People Officer of HubSpot, notes that only one of the 100 names on the list was a woman, and that there are exactly zero women of colour or LGBTQ women represented, and there are more men named Stanley than women. Kate goes on to write, "Ultimately, I'm disappointed not just in the list, but in the broader narrative about women in leadership. Last year, I ran a workshop on women's leadership and asked everyone in attendance of all genders to list admired executives. Their lists look frighteningly similar to the Forbes list. Male names flowed easily, but people struggle to name female executives. Simply put, we raise people of all genders to associate men with executive leadership, and it has a detrimental effect on how we think about, support and promote leadership." Kate, do you agree with Katie Burke that without female leaders that we regularly reference, admire and promote, we'll never achieve gender parity in lists, recognition or leadership roles?
I do. I think Katie's making an important point here. Some months ago, I was attending a conference, and in the final session, there was a panel, and there were all men on the panel, and one of them drew attention to that fact. And at the end of the discussion, when we were asked the questions, my question was, what are each of you going to do in the future to ensure you're never on an all-male panel again? What's your individual commitment to diversity? It was a very unpopular question. And in fact, one of the panel members said, are we going to answer this? Or are we going to talk about something important? But what it highlighted for me was it's difficult. It's more onerous. You have to try a little bit harder to get female panel members, to find women who are worthy to be on the top 10 or the top 100. It's just about effort. It's not that they're not there, but the easy go-to names are the ones that people will go to first. So if you challenge yourself and say, right, I'm doing top 100, I want some diverse representation, just try that bit harder to do it. And no, it's that much more effort. And that will see a change when the lists have more women on them, more people from diverse backgrounds. They then become easy to go on other people's lists.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story takes a slightly different view. We look at a BBC documentary series, Japan with Sue Perkins, that focused on the so-called Hell Camp Business School outside Tokyo. The two-week intensive management training course appeared to be conducted mainly through shouting. Delegates introduced themselves by shouting out their failures as a manager to each other, and those who didn't shout loud enough were asked to go outside and practice shouting louder. Delegates were deemed to have started the course from a position of ignorance and inadequacy, and literally wore badges of shame that were removed one by one if they demonstrated competence going through the course. Failure is seen as shameful, and 80% of the intake failed and returned to their companies in disgrace. Kate, how would you reconcile this Japanese culture of formality and ritual with the Institute's dimensions of leadership?
Well, the Institute's first dimension of leadership is authenticity, and we believe that begins with self-awareness. And rather than getting involved in some sort of cultural imperialism where we start saying, well, this is really poor and they shouldn't be developing their managers like that, let's think about what self-awareness means and put that in a cultural context. For us, it's much more of a focus on our strengths. Whereas in Tokyo, their high degree of self-awareness, they're just starting somewhere else because culturally that would appear to get them the results that they want. So let's suspend critical judgment about this and let's think if it delivers the result that it wants to. And I think when you saw the people who did graduate, there was a huge amount of pride in achieving a very high standard. Again, that's a different sort of approach than perhaps one we'd take here. But nevertheless, it is about knowing what you're good at, knowing what you're not so good at, and really working hard.
Thank you very much, Kate. Is there any news this week from the Institute that our listeners would be interested in?
Well, one of the reasons I was so interested in this Japanese program was because we're just announcing our International Leadership Week, which is taking place in November of this year. Absolutely, totally online, free, digital conference with speakers from all over the world. And we'll be addressing some of these questions about not better, not worse, just different.
Thank you very much, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the news and views sections on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.